The following material is unclassified. All information disseminated or discussed is derived solely from open sources and is exclusively the opinion of the presenter. Nothing in this discussion shall be considered to be an official position or policy or a representation of the official positions or policies of the United States.
In the 1960s, the United States has deployed Polaris nuclear missile-armed submarines within range of major targets in the Soviet Union. Powerful men on both sides believe that war is inevitable. It is only a question of when. And who will strike first? In this international environment, the United States develops the Single Integrated Operating Plan, or SIOP. Constantly reviewed and updated, the SIOP is the United States war plan in the event of nuclear war. At its heart is the operational concept known as the Triad.
First of all, I just want to tell you what a great show you got. I listen to you all the time.
Thank you. What do you want to talk about?
Hey, did I tell you guys I got a goat?
I have directed the armed forces to prepare for any eventuality. And I trust that in the interest of both the Cuban people and the Soviet technicians at the site, the hazards to all concerned of continuing this threat will be recognized. It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response on the Soviet Union.
Little column A, little column B.
Yeah, baby!
Well, good morning, good evening, or good afternoon, wherever you are, whatever you do. A lot of things happening in the world today. Most of them are far beyond our control, you might say. So, perhaps it's time we took a pause and thought about life and thought about the laws of gravity, history, submarines, nuclear missiles, the Cold War. Maybe some politics under the news, but it'll be old stuff. Don't touch that dial. Just try to hear me out for a little while. Well, I got asked an interesting question yesterday about ballistic missile submarines and why we just didn't use those instead of having all these missile silos all over the Midwest and the likes of that. There's actually a pretty good answer to that. Some of it may surprise you. Some of it may not. What else is new? All right, here's how you get a hold of me. The text machine is area code 209-565-DAVE. That's 209-565-3283. The email, Dave at thedavebowmanshow.com. And, of course, we're on the web. Just look for the plausiblylive.com or look for The Dave Bowman Show on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and SoundCloud. Ego bibere capulus et olive verve. I drink coffee that others might live. So, yeah, I was, first off, let me apologize for yesterday. I know I said I was going to be here for Constitution Thursday, and I just completely blanked that it was my 10th wedding anniversary. Just gone. I don't know what I was thinking. That's the second time I blanked that. And that was not good. Plus, I had a doctor's appointment yesterday, which went really well, with one exception. I've been having problems with my hearing, and I haven't talked a lot about this because I gripe enough on this show about my health, and maybe I didn't need to do that, but I've been losing my hearing since April, and it's just getting worse and worse and worse, and finally yesterday I was at the doctor, and so I said, I can't hear. My left ear, I'm deaf. I can't hear. And my right ear is not much better. I mean, and my wife is getting mad at me because she's constantly yelling at me, and I'm having to say, we literally had an argument. We don't have arguments. We really don't. I mean, 10 years, I don't think we've had a real argument. But she was getting mad at the fact that I kept saying, what all the time. And so now I say, I didn't hear that. I'm sorry. I don't know what you said. I know you're talking to me, but I can't hear the word. I can't make it out. Anyway, so I go to the doctor yesterday thinking to myself the worst. This is going to be terrible. Back in April when we were in California, my left ear went completely dark. I mean, I just couldn't hear anything. And I actually ended up at that point, we were in the mountains. And so I thought maybe it was pressure stuff. So I was clearing my ears and I, you know, did the finger thing and womp, womp, womp. And it cleared. And so I was, you know, okay. Anyway, he looks in my ears and he says, oh, yeah, you got a big buildup of wax down there. really deep down there. I mean, it's not like I'm not cleaning my ears. Okay. So don't send me those emails or texts. This is really way down in there. So they tried to clean it and God bless them. Not only did they not manage to clean it, they made it worse. So if the sound is a little off, it's because I can't hear it. And I'm trying to do the best I can visually, but if it's off, anyway, I got to go see a ENT guy in the next few days. And supposedly they have this vacuum suction thing that's going to suck it all right out of there. And then my ears should be back to normal. And there you go. Plus it was our 10th wedding anniversary. And so, we were celebrating that and I just completely blanked all that. But in the middle of all that, I made a post on my personal page about, one of the submarines, one of the traditional 41, what we call the 41 for freedom boats. And I got this response from Alan. Serious question. With nuclear submarines carrying nuclear missiles, why do we still need all these missile bunkers all over the Midwest? Why not just go deep and keep moving out of sight? And my reply to him was, that's a very good question. It's a question that a lot of people ask. It's one of those questions that people look at and they go, well, why do we have all this? I mean, what the heck are we doing here? Why do we need all this? And the answer is going to surprise you, or it may not. There are multiple facets and layers to that question that you have to go back in history again, of course, because the reason we do things the way we do is at its core issue because we're Americans. I mean, that's what it runs down to, is because we're Americans. Back in the 1960s, the world was on the nuclear trigger. I don't think today we really understand how close that was. Of course, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, it was considered to be the closest we've ever come to nuclear war. There were other times, Abel Archer in 83, when the NATO in the United States conducted a military drill in Europe, and the Soviets thought it was real and began to react as if it was real. We don't really have this concept today. Today we look at that era somewhat quaintly with this idea that, well, it was never realistic or whatever. I grew up in an era when the idea that we were going to fight a war against the Russians, Soviets, was a given. I mean, it was just a matter of when. It wasn't a question of if, it was just a question of when. Right down to the fact that Tom Clancy was writing books about it and Larry Bond were writing books about it. People were writing books about it all the time, about the fact that we were going to have these fights with the Russians and we needed to be prepared and we needed to war game these things out. And we played war games that had that same thing in it. Victory games had Second Fleet, Harpoon. Some of the earliest computer games were about that. And like I said, it was a different world. And so into this world was born this concept of how do we prepare for this? Now, Harry Truman said, anybody starting a nuclear war is insane, and I'm not going to do that. Clement Attlee, who happened at the same time to be Prime Minister of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, said, and I quote, "Twice is he armed who gets in the first blow," unquote. In other words, it was basically the policy of the British government that we should strike first, that we should just, you know, we should plan on a first strike against the Soviet Union. If we thought that we were going to go to nuclear war, we should take them out first. And this has become kind of an interesting doctrine when it comes to nuclear warfare, because there's a couple of things you could do. You can strike first. But in general, the idea following that has always been this idea that mutual assured destruction. And this was the concept that we would have the ability post all of that to annihilate you. And so the United States began flying nuclear bombers, nuclear armed bombers, almost around the clock. We had a thing known as Operation Chrome Dome. It wasn't thrown by the B-36s. Which are some of the most beautiful airplanes ever built. Castle Air Museum has one of these, and it's a reconnaissance version, but it's just a beautiful plane. But it was built to carry nuclear bombs to the Soviet Union. And later replaced with the B-52s, the idea here was that these planes would, no matter if the Soviets launched their ICBMs at us and attacked us, even if they got in the first strike, we would retaliate so fiercely, so strongly, and so devastatingly that it would give them pause. And this became the concept of deterrence. We flew Operation Chrome Dome, which was the B-52s, constantly on alert over the northern parts of the hemisphere and near the Soviet Union on 24-hour alerts, and so that they could constantly, if we needed to, attack first. We could go in with those bombers and attack first, because we still had to have a plan for that. And what was developed over the years was what was known as the PSIOP, S-I-O-P, stands for Single Integrated Operating Plan. Now, again, there was a time when the word PSIOP was classified. It was confidential. You couldn't even talk about it. Now it's on Wikipedia, in great detail on Wikipedia. It's declassified. It's defunct. I mean, we don't have it anymore. But what the Single Integrated Operating Plan was this idea of how we would fight a nuclear war. And it began in the late 1950s with the development of, you know, okay, who do we attack? If there is a war, do we just go after the Soviet Union? Do we go after the Eastern Bloc countries? Do we go after Red China? Do we have? And at one point, the PSIOP contained what we would later call an MAO, major attack option, which was just basically hit everybody at once. And it was up to the Marines. The Marine commandant actually is the one that raised the question about whether or not that was a smart thing to do. Because in his view, I mean, okay, so we hit China and we hit, say, you know, Romania. But what if we're not at war with China or Romania? What if they're not even involved with the conflict? This is actual data from the 1956 major attack option. This was actually the nuclear plan for the United States, nuclear plan for the United States. And you can see most of it hits military bases in the Soviet Union. But a lot of it is outside of the Soviet Union and borderline in places that, well, is there any real, what if we weren't fighting them? But the original MAO included everybody, and there was no option to scale that back or scale that down or whatever. You know, it was just, here's the code, go. Major Kong, you know, nuclear war toe-to-toe with the Ruskies. And off we would go. Through the years, they scaled that down, and they made arrangements, and they changed things around so that the MAO was much less. And we scaled down the MAOs to the point where there were plans to limit things. So, you know, what if it was just Russia, the Soviet Union? What if, for God's sakes, it was just East Germany? What if it was, you know, Poland? What if it was China? What if it was North Korea? And what if it was, you know, as John Hackett, General Sir John Hackett, postulated in his book, The Third World War, back in 1979, whenever it was. What if it was just a very limited exchange? In other words, it was a ground war in Europe, a la Tom Clancy's book, Red Storm Rising. What if there was a ground war and it was going badly for the Soviets? And so as a political point, they launched one weapon and took out one city to make a point. And we would have to respond in kind. Okay, you took out one of our cities, we're going to take out one of yours. And then cooler heads will prevail. That was actually the thought process that Hackett, General Sir John Hackett, actually postulated in 79. I bought the book in 80. I know that. I begged my dad to let me buy it. Anyway, point being that the PSIOP began to mold itself so that it was adaptable to various situations. Well, of course, that means you got to have constant communications, because you can't just say go anymore. Now you got to say, no, do this, 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 and this, or do that, or change this target to that target. And things became a lot more complicated in all of this. So in the middle of all this, you're looking at not just that, but now you've got this question of, well, what assets do we have to use for this? And this is where Alan's question really gets kind of interesting, because if you go back to the 1950s, the end of World War II, the birth of the atomic age, the Air Force under the command of Lieutenant General Curtis LeMay, who was, let's just call him intense. Let's just call him, you know, the Patton of the Air Force. He was pretty tense. He was an uptight kind of guy, but he truly and honestly believed that Air Force, the air power, could win anything. That we didn't even need an army. We certainly didn't need a Navy in his book. And Air Force could drop bombs on anybody, anywhere, anytime, and that would be that. And the overwhelming sentiment was that we got so many bombers, you know, I mean, so if we lose 10% or 20% or even 50%, we still get the bombs through. We still take out the Soviet Union and okay, there you go. Well, cooler heads kind of figured out that, you know, look, anti-air defenses are becoming stronger. They're becoming, you know, radars becoming a thing and jet fighters and the likes of that. And the B-52 is still somewhat, you know, down the thing. The B-36, while beautiful, it really isn't, it's just not up to that. I mean, it's not going to hang in there. And so in the early 1950s, the Navy began working on something called Regulus, which was a first naval-launched guided missile. It was actually based on the V-1 buzz bomb, the Germans. We modified three World War II submarines to carry it. So that's one of them there. That's the Tusk, the Tunny. And we put this big hangar on the thing with some rails, and they would pull that thing out of there, and they would pull this missile that looked like a fighter jet, and they would launch it off of there. And it had a range of about 500 miles or so, and it could carry a pretty good size. I think it was 10 megaton nuclear weapon. And we built five of these submarines. We had the three World War II boats, and then they built two more diesel-powered regular submarines and one nuclear-powered submarine. And they carried Regulus, and they made patrols well into the 1970s. Well, 1960s anyway. And Regulus became the first strategic missile from a ship. But the problem is, of course, it wasn't very accurate. It was replaced then by the Polaris missile system, which was carried aboard ballistic missile submarines, which were more effective than the regular submarines because they could launch their missiles underwater and they had greater range. The range of the SLBMs would change over time. Start with the A-1, which was the very first one in 1960. That was improved by the A-2 and the A-3. This was all Polaris, and it had a range of about, I don't know, 1,500 miles or so, nautical miles, maybe 2,500 by the A3 range. But it was a fairly limited missile in the sense that it didn't carry MIRVs, MIRVs, multiple independent retargeted vehicles or bombs that could be dropped at different places. The A3 did have multiple warheads, but they were not independently targetable. They were replaced by the C3. Now, I was actually trained on C3 and C4, and both C3 and C4, roughly the same size missile, new submarines, the 640 class, the 616 class, or the 627 class submarines were modified to carry these particular missiles. They carried multiple independent retargeting vehicles, and they were highly accurate. This is where the differences come in. And then eventually those were replaced by D5 long after I left. And those, of course, were placed aboard the Ohio-class submarine, which I served upon, the USS Michigan, in all of this. Now, why does all this matter? Well, the problem with the bombers, of course, was they were going to get shot down, and they could be defended against, and they could be defeated. The land-based missiles that you see all over the Midwest are actually, from a strategic standpoint, these are your primary weapons. And the reason for that is because they're land-based, they're not moving. And their target is not moving. Now the Earth is revolving, I get it, but the two targets, and so these are the most hyper-accurate missiles you have. They don't miss. So as long as they get off successfully, and that's why they're in these armored hangars and the likes of that, as long as they get off successfully, they're going to hit their target for all intents and purposes. There's no way they're going to miss. But the problem is they can be counterforced by a first strike from the Soviets. So you got all these missiles in the tubes. If the Soviets fly their bombers over and hit the tubes, well, maybe they destroy the missiles, maybe they don't, maybe they damage them, maybe they don't, maybe the tube can't open, whatever, and then you've lost your ability to be highly accurate, okay? That's the one theory. So then you've got that, but then you've got the bombers that can go on and drop the bombs, and then you have the submarines. The submarines are the most protected. They are the most difficult to counterforce by the Russians, by the Soviets. But because they're at sea, which is moving around on a ship, and that ship is rocking back and forth and going up and going down and side to side and all those kinds of things, and the target is set still, they're the least accurate, at least during the initial phases of this whole thing. When you have A1 to C3, they're reasonably accurate, but not highly accurate, not highly inaccurate enough to do what's called counterforce, which means that they can't be used as really a first strike weapon. These are seen as weapons of retaliation, deterrence. These are weapons that are used to deter a Soviet attack by reminding them that if they do attack, even if they get all their bombers through, and even if they take out all of our land-based missiles and shoot down all of our bombers, they can't find our submarines. And that's been since 1960. They can't find these things. Hell, we can't find these things for the most part. And there you go. And so these things are out there. They're carrying either 16 or 24 missiles each into the 1980s. They only carry 20 now. But the bottom line is they carry these missiles. And so you can't find them. You can't destroy them. You can't retaliate against them. And they're going to hit you. So it puts in your mind the idea that, well, okay, even though we took out their highly accurate land-based missiles and their reasonably accurate bombers, we can't do anything about those. And those things are just going to hit our cities and they're just going to annihilate stuff. And what's the point of fighting this war then, right? I mean, that's where we're at. And so this leads to the development of what's known as the triad. So you have this three-pronged idea of deterrence. You have the bombers, which are, highly survivable and reasonably accurate. You have the land-based missiles, which are not really survivable if they get hit by a first strike, but they are hyper-accurate. I mean, seriously accurate. And then they're so accurate that those land-based missiles, the Atlas, the Titan, it's what we use to launch our spacecraft, certainly in the early parts of the space program. And then you have the most survivable, but at that time least accurate, the ballistic missile submarines. Times have changed and, things have gone by the wayside. But the reason we put all those missiles on those submarines and still kept the ones on land was because, again, you go back to that PSYOP, there may come a time where we want to attack first. And if you want to attack first, you definitely want to use a highly accurate missile. So there's your land-based missile so that you're ready to go. I mean, again, if you're going to make a first attack, what you want to do is what's known as a C3 decap, command, control, communications, decapitation. You want to take out systems that will allow your enemy to respond. So you use those highly accurate ICBMs that will hit those things, the Minuteman, the MX, and the Titan, and you hit those things first. Theoretically, if they haven't had time to respond, then they don't have time to respond. But of course, they've got ballistic missile submarines as well. So they're going to retaliate, and it balances the equation on an international standpoint. And that's kind of where that comes from. And that kind of is why they're still out there. It's intersectional rivalry between the Air Force, the Navy, and believe it or not, the Army. And at the same time, it's a balance between what do we got to have in order to maintain the peace. And it's not always as simple as just saying, well, we've got one kind of bomb and that's going to do it. And at the end of the day, that's it. And that there you have it. Now, what changed the whole equation was this realization in the 1980s of Reagan's Star Wars defense program, which was designed to defend against first strike weapons so that the Soviet Union could not attack us without us being able to survive that, thus keeping intact our first strike weapons. And the second thing that came across was the C-4 missile, which was a sea-launched submarine ballistic missile, but it was highly accurate, is the best way I can describe it. It was highly accurate. And later replaced by the D-5 missile, which was coming online just as I was getting out. And the D-5 is as accurate as the land-based ICBMs. There's some reasons why. I'm not going to go into it, but all you really need to understand is that these missiles, which the Soviets cannot find and cannot counterforce, were now essentially both first strike and second strike weapons. And this combined with the Strategic Defense Initiative and the Soviet Union trying to spend to equal that, but their economy wasn't geared to be able to do that. In our economy, you spend money on the Strategic Defense Initiative, you're paying people. Those people are going out and buying stuff. They're paying taxes on that. They're paying taxes on their income. It feeds back into itself. And it kind of becomes a self-feeding, even if it's, you know, deficit spending, but you've got some assets there. In a Soviet centralized economy, you don't have that. And so they spent themselves into oblivion trying to counter our ability to first strike, and it bankrupted them. And that's ultimately what happened, is those hyperactive MX missiles, the land-based MX missiles, along with the Trident submarine launch ballistic missiles and the standoff cruise missiles that the Air Force had. All of a sudden, it changed the equation. They changed the counterforce equation, and that created a lot of problems. The reason you have all this different stuff is because you don't put all your eggs in one basket. You know, if you do that, you're just inviting trouble. What happens if all your fleet is in port on a Sunday morning in December and you hit it all at the same time? Well, what happens if all your bombers can't take off? What happens if, you know, your missiles get counterforced? Well, you have this alternate way of doing it, and that's why you put them in these different places, in these different boxes, with these different mixes that make up the PSYOP, or made up the PSYOP in those days, and allowed us to keep the peace from 1960 on. It's pretty amazing stuff, and like I said, I'm just scratching the surface of it, and I'm not giving you anything classified or confidential about it, but it was an amazing experience and something I'm very proud of. We kept the peace for all those years and brought down the Soviet Union. Of course, other dangers have come into place, and I'm not so sure that those new dangers understand the game the way the Soviets did, and that's part of the problem. I got to get going. Take the time right now. Tell the people that matter in your life you love them very much. You'd miss them if they weren't there, so don't pass up those opportunities. You don't want to have that regret. Plausibly Live, I'm Dave Bowman. This is my show, The Dave Bowman Show, right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. And we'll see you back here on Monday for a brand new episode of Plausibly Live, The Dave Bowman Show.
The Dave Bowman Show is a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. For more information or to complain about how the show offended you, the text or voicemail number is 209-565-DAVE. For more information about the show, log on to thedavebowmanshow.com.
Hey, I'm going to go do something productive. I'm going to go watch television.